And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's August 23rd, and we are, of course, in a time of crisis and challenge, folks. This is the voice of the resistance and the Republic of Canada, a common law republic which has universal jurisdiction, embraces all men and women of goodwill and of liberty. Well, in the cold time of the American Revolution, when the Continental Army had shrunk down to a couple of thousand stalwart patriots facing the biggest empire on the planet, a good man called Thomas Paine wrote these words: "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and the thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value." And brothers and sisters who are listening today, everything that matters to us, everything of value, is at risk of annihilation. Our children, our liberties, our planet. Our backs are to the wall, and more people are waking up to this, which is why our common law assembly movement is spreading all over the planet, not just in Canada, and not here, just here in Turtle Island, but everywhere. I'm getting constant affirmation of that. And I got a wonderful letter I want to share with you. It was kind of like our version of The Crisis by Tom Paine, that letter that boosted the morale of the tired revolutionaries when they're at their lowest point. It was a letter I received this last week from a woman in Alberta. I want to read it to you, at least the major parts of it. She wrote, "I recently finished Kevin Annett's truthful text entitled Murder by Decree. I am changed. I immediately wrote the following entry, and along with my family, I will fill out the oath of citizenship to become proud citizens of the new sovereign Republic of Canada. We are rural citizens in Alberta. While reading these pages of Kevin's, I have a despair inside, a shameful feeling. If we were allowed to know this truth, what could we have done? Can we forgive? Can we be forgiven? I'm ashamed to be Canadian. I'm ashamed of my Prime Minister. I'm ashamed to be part of the British Commonwealth. I'm ashamed to admit I have felt prejudice towards Indians. I'm ashamed to have believed that a single apology and monetary compensation could heal a people. I'm ashamed to have been denied my country's true history. I'm ashamed believing that creating new taxes and laws will create justice for us. I'm ashamed to say that no one has taught me that the plight the Indians have endured on their home soil. I'm ashamed to have believed Indians could heal from their generational traumas. I'm ashamed there is no Indian Lives Matter. I'm ashamed the Indian Act still exists in Canada. I'm ashamed a genocide happened in my country and no one will call it by its name. Genocide. I'm ashamed to be Canadian. When will we learn? But I am forever grateful for this gift of knowledge. I am a servant to God and to our new republic." And this woman who represents the best of us, who represents that goodwill and decency among ordinary people that holds and binds the roots of our society together, that inspired me to play what we're going to hear today. And what it is knowing that in order to believe in ourselves the way she does in that letter, the way to carry on in the winter of our struggle, we have to believe in ourselves. We have to know who we are. But to do that, we have to know our history. People have to understand that everything happening now, these measures, the so-called COVID virus restrictions, the mandatory vaccinations, all of it have been inflicted on people in our own nation. The H1N1 outbreak the other year, a few years ago, the swine flu epidemic. In order to test out the Tamiflu drug, Health Canada, which is now pushing these measures on us, went out to the Howsett Indian Reservation and forcibly injected Native children and elders with the Tamiflu drug. As a result, the area that was declared a pandemic because over 50% of the people were sick with the swine flu, deliberately introduced not even 10 years ago, or like 7 years ago when the swine flu nonsense happened. The Big Pharma and the government admitted after it was a fear campaign designed to boost corporate profits. Yet the same forces are telling us now to wear masks and distance and get mandatory vaccinations. That huge lie. That can only be responded to through resolute action. And what we're doing today is we're going to give you some of that history from a talk I gave at Vancouver Island University in October 2009. And right at the start, I say, if we don't stop this now and look at what the genocide that happened is going to happen to us. And very prophetically, that was in 2009. A decade later, it has happened. We have to respond the way we're doing now. We have to bring in our own bylaws in our common law assemblies that say the COVID restrictions and the mandatory vaccinations are outlawed in our community. You're to stand down. In other words, we are to reverse the tables and impose our laws and say these restrictions are not valid. That's what we're doing as we speak in the common law assemblies. You can learn more. Go to Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.ca, murderbydecree.com. But today, listen and learn about the history without which you can't understand what's going on now. You have to understand how these measures are not new, how they were done to others in Kanata and elsewhere, and learn from the movement that exposed this genocide, the movement that we built so painstakingly over the years at the expense of the lives of some of our own people. So this is the show today. As we play it, remember that it's from 2009, so some of the references to the websites are now defunct, but murderbydecree.com, republicofkanata.ca, those are the websites you need to keep in mind. This is from October 2009 from a speech I gave Vancouver Island University. Near the end of the talk, I answer questions, and there'll be pauses as you hear kind of music interrupting the different questions. But it's a complete talk I gave. And you'll also hear at the beginning voices of the Canadian Holocaust, the Native men and women who survived it. Learn, edify yourself, join the movement, write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Carry the fight to the criminals in power. I thank you, brothers and sisters. We'll be back live next week.
I'm very honored to introduce Kevin Annett. Kevin is a Canadian writer, film producer, radio talk show host, as well as a former minister with the United Church of Canada. He has authored two books about Canadian Aboriginals. First book, Love and Death in the Valley, and secondly, Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust. In 2006, Kevin produced an award-winning documentary entitled Unrepentant, Kevin Annett and Canada's Genocide. He is currently working on another film project, The Diary. We're going to hear a clip from that or from Unrepentant?
Well, we can look at both, actually.
Okay. The Diary, I've played the promo. You haven't been on my show since you've been back. Right, okay, we got to do that again. Kevin just came back. You always seem to be on the road, man. It was in Rome, in front of the Vatican.
Yay.
That's a pretty big gate to be knocking on. So, this latest film project is called The Diary, which continues to rewrite the history of Canada's First Nations people. Kevin is more deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize than many who have received it in the past. Dr. Noam Chomsky said that. Bit of a heavy, I suppose. It's kind of a tough one bringing up Chomsky with truthers because Noam, you know, we all learned a hell of a lot from him, didn't we? Let's not forget that. However, what is it when the student surpasses the teacher? Maybe that's who we are, right? Kevin Annett.
And just following that, I want to show you a little clip from our film where you can see the faces and of the men and women who lived through this genocide and who are the witnesses today.
My name's Harry Wilson.
My name's Kenny Quittell.
My name is Virginia Baptiste. I'm from the Osoyoos Indian Band in Oliver, B.C.
My name is Harry Lucas. I'm actually 64 years old.
My name is Tibayot from the House of Tibayot of Achida.
My name is Nankaiska. I come from the people of Haida Gwaii. My English name is Douglas Wilson. In academic circles, I'm known as Dr. Douglas Wilson.
I went to Port au Prince Residential School, 1959 to 1970.
Went to the residential school in Cranbrook, B.C. My first year was 1955. I went until 1963.
I'm a survivor of the Edmonton Indian Residential School. I was there from 1957 to 1961.
At age 5, I was kidnapped by terrorists in a gunboat. The RCMP had this gunboat. It was a RCMP boat with a gun mounted on it to gather children from villages.
We were segregated right from the day one. I remember in September we were all on a beach and we were all given numbers.
When I first got to school in Cranbrook, we were all given a number. My number was 54, and my underwear, my socks, my uniform, my towels, everything that I had a number. It was 54 on there. And all the girls had their own numbers. And if you were caught with somebody else's number, you got whipped for that.
We weren't allowed to have books, but we weren't allowed to read. If you were caught reading any kind of a book or a magazine, you were punished. That was a severe punishment, that one.
The kids who told on us got preferential treatment, whereas the children who sang their songs and spoke their language were punished constantly for any little thing, for even for laughing.
It was always hard for us to tell one another we love you, because we were taught to love was wrong. They told us the love was wrong, that was the devil's work. But yet, these priests and nuns could hug and kiss. And we couldn't even hug our own brothers. We couldn't even hold them and tell them we loved them. It took me a lot of years before I was able to tell my boys I loved them.
3 years it took me to realize it, though, you know, of torture and pain, you know, being strapped at a young, you know, I lost my childhood when I first got there and never knew what it was like to have parents. Still hurts. Sorry about that.
Sorry, you don't apologize.
But I never knew my mother, still don't today.
I couldn't remember any good times that were there because I was being punished for things I'd never done.
Like what kind of punishment?
Punishment by restraining me to the bed, by putting a restrainer on me and holding me down in the bed. I had bed problems as wetting the bed, and they would tie me in bed and put an electric underneath my sheet so that when I did wet, I would electrocute myself.
Did they put you in a hospital?
Yes, I did. Well, yeah, they gave me some drugs or something like that.
What kind? What happened to you?
I don't know what kind of drug it was.
What happened to you when they gave you the drugs?
Hey, they put me in there, like a padded room. Padded room, like? Oh, all strapped down.
That was after you reported the girl?
Yeah.
Finding the girl's body?
Yeah.
I'd seen them burn hands of kids when they're 3 years old and 5, with a little spike in their hand and like that, like a shock thing.
Electric shock?
Yeah.
Device? Why did they shock the kids?
Because the kids wouldn't listen to the Catholic priest.
He used it on my brother's penis. He electrocuted his penis there till my brother passed out. And he was laughing, brother. My brother said he was laughing while he was doing it. You'd like to see him in pain, I guess.
And then the police force, I I was involved in a few investigations regarding the victims of a residential school where one particular individual had went home in the summer and learned how to speak his own language, and his dad had taught him how to carve. And we went back to school. He continued doing this, speaking his own language and carving. And the teacher caught him and took his knife away and broke his carving up. And he took a pencil and he drove it right through his hand. And you still see the scar where he drove the pencil right through his hand.
Then there was other times where they put us in a tub, and then they had a bucket of snakes, you know, them black and yellow snakes. And they'd throw that in the tub while we're having a bath. And the snakes are, they can't stand that hot water. They try and crawl all over our bodies, trying to get away from that hot water. They'd all just curl up because they die immediately. And that was some of the horrifying things that they'd done to us to discipline us to keep quiet.
And anybody who's worked around Native people at all, you know these stories. You know they've been circulated for decades. Yet now, because the Canadian government, under legal pressure and all sorts of moral pressure, has seen fit to apologize for genocide, now the issue is supposed to be over. And I get that all over the country when I go and speak. The attitude of, by and large, a lot of non-Native people who are well-intentioned, good people, say, we've acknowledged this, what more do they want? That, I think, comes out of an attitude that is an issue that assuming this thing is something that happened in the past and to some exotic group of people, that it doesn't involve us at all fundamentally, and it involves something that's gone now. I think the fact that we're only about 100 yards or more from what used to be the Nanaimo Indian Hospital right across Fifth Avenue, along the other side of the fence there, where people were held for decades. There was one woman, Joan Morris, who actually spoke right here in the other room about 5 years ago now, 6 years. And she described how she and her mom were kept in the Nanaimo Indian Hospital for 15 years and used in drug testing, all sorts of other stuff. The thing I think we have to understand is that it's about us and it's about now, because there wouldn't be the things happening to us right now unless they were first tried out on the Aboriginal people of this country. And the Indian Act, which allows forced medical treatment of any Native person on reserve, which imposes a tyrannical regime on any reservation in Canada, which places Native people outside the law and not under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The Permanent War Measures Act and the Homeland Security Act is based on exactly that kind of treatment of people. So you could say, in a way, we're all potentially now going to become Indians, something that's been happening to them for many centuries. So I just say that to let us see that the old saying, an injury to one is an injury to all, is not a moral desire or a nice idea. It's a practical fact that if you let it happen to your neighbor today, it'll happen to you tomorrow. And when I was in Ireland, Raymond mentioned this trip I was on, which I want to talk about. It was quite something. But when I was in Ireland recently, you probably read in the news the Ryan report that came out, which describes how the Roman Catholic Church there did identical things to the unwed mothers and actually anybody they didn't like for decades. And now the government has basically exonerated the Catholic Church for all of these crimes, even though the same stories of mass graves, of torture, of the deaths of children is all over the place. And there were 5,000 Irish people outside the government offices in Dublin, outside the Dáil Éireann, protesting that, because, you see, it wasn't just happening to some exotic group that doesn't touch our life. It was happening to them, their own people. And so if we can do that shift in Canada where we can see that this isn't just about Native people, it's about all of us, that's when, and I had experience of that because about 5 years ago in our campaign, we began to talk not about Native children, but about children, the missing children. About the same time that we started the project that led to the film Unrepentant, we started holding vigils across the country on April 15th, Aboriginal Holocaust Day. And it was part of that momentum that forced the apology, but more importantly, forced people to come out and start talking publicly for the first time about all this. For me, just to summarize, you know, for those who don't know the story, it started for me almost 20 years ago now when I arrived in Port Alberni, just down the road, as a new United Church minister. And the very first Native home I went into, and I was curious about visiting Native people because I looked out on my congregation on my first Sunday and there were no Natives there at all, even though they were one-third of the population. And as I mentioned in our film, which by way, the way you can look at on hiddenfromhistory.org, which is our website, I asked the chair of my board, Fred Bishop, I said, how come there are no Native people in church? I mean, I thought it was the United Church that baptized most of these people. Like, where are they all? And he got pretty uptight. You know, it was a topic I wasn't supposed to go into. And he said, they keep to themselves and we keep to ourselves. And everybody likes it that way, which to me is almost a metaphor for Canada. But he said that, and it got me really curious. So I went out and I got a call that first week to go to a wedding in a native home of a man called Danny Gus. And he and his partner, Clotilde, were getting married. Finally, they wanted to get married after about 30 years of living together. And I asked Danny why we were sitting around after drinking tea, and I asked him why there weren't any Native people in the United Church. And he looked at me like I was an idiot, you know. And then finally he said, they killed my best friend in the residential school, and they buried him in the hill behind what's now the tribal council office there. And the church people all know that. They don't want us in their church. So, you know, that for me opened the door for this. And at the time, the United Church, like the Catholics and Anglicans, weren't facing lawsuits over this. They weren't on the hot plate over this. So they had the freedom to simply deny it all. I was told that the Native people are making all that up because they don't like us for having taken away their land. So just don't listen to these stories. I was told that. And one thing led to another. After 2.5 years, the thing that actually got me fired was my discovery of a history of land theft on the island where, you see, if you were a missionary here and you arrived, there was a thing you were set up, the government set up clergy reserves. So if you went in as a missionary, you automatically got 200 acres on whatever land you pitched your tent on, even if it was somebody's land for 10,000 years, you still got it. And those clergy reserves became, in many cases, the residential schools. They were situated strategically near very wealthy resources that the churches profited off. And eventually the churches sold that land to a lot of corporate benefactors. And one of the immediate issue that got me fired was that I found out that, if you remember, I don't know if you remember this, but back in 1994, Weyerhaeuser, the biggest logging company in the world, bought up McMillan Bloedel. It was the biggest corporate acquisition in BC history. Well, that happened because the church had been acquiring all of this native land on the West Coast, the last of the old growth, in not only in the Walbrand and the Clarkwat, but up in the closer to Tofino there, that the whole Clarkwood Basin. All of that had been a series of deals whereby the church, which had stolen the land, flipped it to McMillan Bloedel, which was a very large contributor to the United Church's charities and that kind of thing. So I found out about this, and I often say to people, naivety and stupidity has its place because it makes you go into places you wouldn't normally go if you were smarter. But I wrote this letter to the United Church, and I said, this is odd because our land claim, our policy in the church says that we have to return all native land in our possession to the First Nation that it came from, right? So I just cited that policy and I said, why then did we sell this or give this land basically to McMillan Bloedel when it belonged to the Housed Nation? So within 4 weeks of writing that letter, I never got a response, but my presbytery began, including actually the man who's now the minister right here in Nanaimo, at St. Andrew's United Church. They all got together with my board and arranged my removal. And when I was summarily fired the next month, I was told that if I wanted to stay a minister, I had to agree to psychiatric evaluation, pastoral retraining, which is called re-education in China, I believe, if I wanted to stay on as a minister, even though I had two young daughters to support and a family to support. And I said, well, no. I mean, where's the evidence that I'm crazy? I'd like to see your evidence, please. So they put me on ice, and it was a long process. I was eventually thrown out of the United Church in what I'm proud to say was the only defrocking of a minister, public defrocking, in United Church history at a cost of $250,000. And it was funny at the time because when it was all happening, I remember the Maclean's magazine that did an article on all this said, well, why are they putting so much energy in getting to get one minister? Like, what's going on here? And that was a question people kept wondering. And I realized eventually, if you go through enough of these crises and ordeals in your life, you have to persist. Because once you persist, you learn what's really going on. And for me, it was a long process of discovery. I had to get hit in the head a few times, I guess, coming out of a position of privilege, of really, like a lot of us as white people, born into a managerial class where we're taught that our job is to run things, and so we have to get the system to work properly. And so a lot of our political and spiritual energy goes into just correcting things, you know, getting the people in power to be aware of what's happening so we can manage things properly. But after losing everything, after being thrown out of the culture, basically, after being not being able to work, losing my children, my family, the church got together with my ex-wife and gave her documents she used in divorce court to make me look like I was crazy. And sure enough, Claire and Eleanor went, I lost custody of my daughters. But all of that, it was kind of like a real learning that I had to go through, because I couldn't really begin to even appreciate what Native people were telling me in the healing circles until I knew some of that pain in my own life, what it means to lose your children, what it means. It's not like an abstract issue anymore. It was, yeah. I mean, I was sitting there and they understood. They could. I felt a bit of that pain. And so I began to learn, unlearn, and learn. And it struck me when I was in Europe, when I was just going all over Europe, how this happened. I mean, I knew this abstractly, but it really hit me in the gut, how this genocide had started so long ago, and it happens to so many of our people too, and that's why we're here, because of that exact same genocide. I was in Parma, which is in the north part of Italy, and I went into this little church. It was the Valdense Church, which was an early Protestant in the 1300s. Congregation, and they had been exterminated almost out of existence by the Catholic Church. They were hunted down and killed mercilessly. And there was this little congregation of these people who had somehow survived that persecution for 700 years. And this pastor heard through my translator, they heard, you know, who I was and what I had been doing. So he goes, come on up. He turns the pulpit over to me and as I began to talk about a little bit about what I knew of the genocide in Canada, how it had been started, you know, by both the Catholic and Protestant churches, although originally initiated by the Vatican, they were all nodding. They understood right away because they had lived through it. They knew what it was like to be an enemy of the state, to live under the gun, to know that you could be killed at any moment. And it puts it in a totally different light when you're living in that reality. And so for me, it was like an amazing experience because I realized all of a sudden it hit. My own family went through this. My family were Huguenots in France, and they had to come over to England and then eventually over here because they were, wherever they went, they were killed because of who they were. And that's the core of the idea right at the heart of genocide, is you're not allowed to be who you are. You've got to be us or you're going to die. And Aboriginal people on this continent, the most targeted group in human history, the most recipient of the worst genocide in human history, were the most latest victims of that, something that started millennia ago. And we can go into some of the history of that. But it clicked for me all of a sudden. This is affecting all of us. And we're all refugees. And those people who are refugees of genocide or within a family are refugees and survivors of abuse. We do it automatically unless we're aware of it. Unless there's somebody to say, look at what you're part of. Look at what you're perpetuating. And for me, I think this trip to Europe was a way for me to situate myself finally in this whole narrative of genocide, which I began to do. And I was looking around Europe when I was there, and I was so marveling. I mean, it was like this amazing human heritage we have, this amazing history and culture that we all come out of that has the capacity to allow men and women to persist and survive through this. I mean, we're an amazing species. And it struck home to me that when we are faced with all the things the brothers have been talking about today and the sisters and all of us who are involved in these struggles, you know, we're hit with the enormity of what we're facing now on the planet, the plan of extermination, global extermination, which I believe is in place, which was tried out sure on Aboriginal people and which is aimed still primarily at them as one of the most weakest ones among us, most vulnerable, and yet aimed at all of us. And then I realize, what do we have ultimately to defend ourselves against that is our own soul. And that's the thing that's really targeted here. I understood, you know, when the practice here in the residential schools, automatic shaving of head, automatic rape, regardless of how young you are, standard procedure when you went into a residential school. What is that designed to do? It's designed to dehumanize and so alienate the little boy and girl that they can never be themselves again. They can never recover themselves again. They'll be sick and dependent, which is what the Indian affairs industry needs. It's what our system needs, to have us all sick and dependent. So all of that, the only defense we have, as they had in the residential school, the only defense the kids had was to hide. You couldn't fight it. There was no way they could fight it. And I learned that, you know, that's something that I found hard to accept at first, being educated and white and coming out of a position of privilege. I couldn't imagine a situation where you couldn't fight back and stop it. And yet that was the situation. There was nothing they could do. Unless they were hidden by their own parents, which happened. Some of the people you'll see in the film are those who were protected in some way and so have the ability to speak about this stuff, but most weren't. And if you survived, and half of them didn't, we know that probably as many as 100,000 children over a century in this country didn't survive these death camps called residential schools. If you survived that, you did it by hiding away some part of yourself. And I remember a woman telling me that in early her healing circles. She said, the reason I had to bury love for my own family and for my children is because that way they couldn't steal it from me. And I wasn't even aware that was in me, right? I wasn't even aware that was there until I found others able to talk about it. And so it's like, for me, it's all kind of a metaphor for like what we're facing now. We can't lose our voice ever. And yet in the recent history in Canada, where the response of the government and the churches has been, okay, we're going to apologize and give money and that'll fix everything, you know, which is absurd, of course, but to them, that's an answer. And what's really behind all of that absurdity is a simple agenda, and that's to silence the eyewitnesses once and for all. Because when you accept money in these so-called compensation packages of the $10,000 maximum, which are allowed, you know, for the destruction of your life, if you go along with that and apply for that money, you have to indemnify the churches. That means you sign a document that says, I will never sue you. My descendants will never sue you. You're not guilty of anything in any way. In effect, you're innocent. Okay? You have to indemnify them. You have to sign off any action. That's designed to simply silence people and stop the truth from getting out. The same reason that in 1999, the government officially sealed all of the records to the Indian hospitals, like the Nanaimo Indian Hospital here. They're sealed. You can't get into the National Archives anymore. Look at that stuff. All of that is designed to control the information, to silence the witnesses, and to carry on as usual. So it'll happen again. So in a way, it's kind of like that's what we're all facing now. Whenever we unearth anything, and the system operates the same way, regardless of what the issue is. Containment. You know, we all know about what that is. We've all experienced in some way. The containment process is about, and the process of apology is very interesting, because don't forget the word apology in the English language has a double meaning. And an apologetic is to defend one's action. An apology can mean not only I'm sorry for something, but I didn't do anything wrong, that I was justified in what I did. And when Stephen Harper recently declared to the world that Canada never had a history of colonialism, if you remember that little gem, that's a way for him to say, I didn't really mean it, Parliament. You know, I said, yeah, children died, yeah, sure, but they were Indians. And don't forget, under the law, Indians aren't citizens. So where does that leave us? I mean, and I want to kind of stop so we can have some time for discussion, and because knowledge, I really believe, and I've learned, is held collectively in the whole circle. And so I want all of us to talk about not only what we know, but what we do, which I think is the essential thing here. And it's really hard when we get into that area. But one of the things I want to leave with you is a few things. when I was in Rome, I was invited there to come by an Aboriginal solidarity group to come and face the Pope. And because the whole genocidal history was, and specifically the residential schools were started because of a master plan the Vatican thought up in the 1870s in Canada under a guy called Bishop Duryea, who created the model for the residential schools. And simply, you know, for about 4 years now, we've been saying a simple thing to the Catholic, Anglican, United Churches, and that is, tell us where these children are buried. They need a proper burial. They need to be brought home. Our letters have never been answered. The issue was only addressed tangentially in Parliament by, I think, Gilles Duceppe made reference to many children not coming home. There was a promise of a missing children's task force, which, according to the Globe and Mail, has never really manifested. We released a list several years ago of 28 mass graves near former residential schools, including one right over here next door by the Indian Hospital. Nothing ever done about it. As a matter of fact, the RCMP's official position in Port Alberni is there are no graves there. So we've been asking that for a long time about the graves, and it was interesting because when I was in Rome, I did this memorial service outside the Vatican simply to reinforce that demand, to say the most basic thing is to bring the children home, and so that's what we're asking you to do. And the way I did it was really funny because it was on a Sunday morning, it was October 11th, the Pope does his weekly mass in St. Peter's Square. He stands up on his palatial little balcony and with all the cardinals in red all around him. And he was speaking to people and leading them in prayer. And there were hardly anybody. It was kind of funny. There was maybe a couple of hundred people in front of the Vatican that day. But what I did is after he spoke, I got out, I brought some soil from a grave in Mission at the Catholic residential school there where a lot of kids are buried. And I used that in the service. And it was kind of funny because it was also fashioned almost as a rite of exorcism where we're kind of calling the spirit of the Vatican to step forth behind the from behind the mask and from behind the lies and face what they are. And it was funny because the next morning after I spoke for about 10 minutes, I did a kind of a anointing and prayer service there. And the next morning, a tornado hit Rome for the first time in about 35 years. There was a picture right on the front of Repubblica, which is the main newspaper in Rome, one of the main papers, and it showed all these chairs and shit covered all over in the front of the Vatican that had been blown there, right? So one of my translators said, wow, Kevin, you know, like, that's these, and no, seriously, the forces that are being unleashed by this are fundamental because it's not only about hundreds of thousands of children here. It's about, think of all of the blood on the hands of that church. I mean, think of the crimes. Thank you. And think of what's being unleashed by a simple call to have the truth step out from behind the mask. And so it's funny, you know, I kind of thought, oh, well, coincidence. But 2 days after that, I got a call. I was up in Genoa, which is Christopher Columbus's hometown. And the city council there actually sponsored my talk. They said they felt they had a moral imperative to sponsor a talk about the genocide from where Columbus had left from. And I got a call from this cardinal. He was going to come to the meeting because he'd been invited. And this guy was apparently fairly senior. He's head of all the council of bishops in Rome. So, I mean, he's that's the actual power, not the figurehead of the papacy, but the actual power in the curia. And this guy apologized for not being able to come, and he said that when I return in April, hopefully we're trying to bring a number of survivors from the residential schools with me next time so they can breathe air right at the Vatican. He said he'd be willing to sit down and talk to us about these demands. Now, of course, as the oldest corporation in the world, you're going to do that kind of containment thing. You're going to make it look like you're doing the right thing. So I don't have any illusions necessarily that mean suddenly the Vatican is going to disclose everything. But what it is, what it indicates is the power of truth. In that, I mean, who the hell am I? I'm just this guy who was fired. I was a minister up in Port Alberni, right? And who are the people I work with? They're down and out by and large. They don't have any means. They're not in the band council system of money. They're mostly homeless Native people living in Vancouver, but we persisted over 15 years. We made a film about it, and we got it out to the world. And look at the reverberation, because we're sitting on a vast thing called the truth. And that's true about anything we do. When you're standing on the truth, you can't give up because you have enormous power. And that's something that I learned that is really important for all of us now at a time of flagging spirits. And this is, I think, what I want to end on, in that the power of the truth and the power of witness. And what that does is means, okay, you're armed with this information and now gives us a responsibility. The responsibility of thinking of all those kids who never came back and all the people dying now on East Hastings and the ones who are going to die tomorrow from this. You know, we have a responsibility for them and to us, right, to our own integrity, to say we have to keep speaking about this and broadening it all the time to let us see that this is about a machine, a genocidal machine that started millennia ago. And it took, it's kind of like I was standing there in Rome and it was amazing because I'm standing in front of the Vatican and I'm thinking, this is where it all began. I mean, this is the Roman effing empire, okay? This is the Roman empire taken, transmit, and it's the spirit. And I, you know, I don't know what your stand is on all of this, but I won't presume because I think there's 9 billion ways to God, as they say, but I really believe in that moment that whatever the spirit was of conquest and slaughter that was the Roman Empire somehow got switched over into the Roman Catholic Church. When the Roman Catholic Church, and we know historically how that happened in the 4th century, when the church took on the symbols and the ethos of the empire that said, okay, we're not Christ anymore. You see, the church isn't the descendant of Jesus Christ. It's the descendant of Emperor Constantine. Jesus Christ was killed and eliminated from the ethos and the spirit of the church. That's why the Roman Catholic symbol is a man on a cross. They worship the corpse because they killed him. And what I understand, they killed the most basic teaching of loving your enemy. It's why no church in the world, Christian church, can practice it in time of war, because they're not allowed to, because of the symbiotic relationship they're in with the state. They become something else called Christendom. And what that is a religion of conquest that said we have the right to destroy anybody who's not like us. You are like us or you die. So it became a genocidal force in the world. And when we're talking genocide, we have to look at and uproot that tradition within our culture of Christendom. And that's a tall order because they hold a lot of power still, apparent power. Every prime minister in Canada except Stephen Harper and Kim Campbell were Roman Catholics, going right back to Pierre Trudeau. And the power of the Roman Catholic Church appears to be a lot. But why then would that cardinal have phoned? Why would you have had every media in Rome covering what I did? Why would national radio, by the time I got to Ireland, national radio called me up and said, we want you to come and talk, because this is right what we're facing in Ireland. This is exactly the same institution and cover-up and murder that went on here. So it all began to come together for me, and it's taken long enough. And for me, I'm just grateful. And I'm always glad to be in places with like this with all of you, because it's the face-to-face contact. You know, when a brother here was talking about the electronic technology and what it does to us and how it ends up dividing us and creating that sense of hopelessness, our antidote to that is simply flesh and blood, hand-to-hand, heart-to-heart, mind-to-mind. And that's what I hope we can encourage in these kinds of gatherings. Carol and I live right down the street, and if any of you live around here, I'd be happy to work with you more. It's on many different levels, this work, and it isn't confined just to this thing of genocide, because like I say, we are engaged in something which is planetary and which is now a final battle for our species, for our real species, for our soul as the human race. I believe we're engaged in that final battle. And so this is something that we have to learn from our brothers and sisters in the native world. How have they survived genocide for centuries? Because we're going to need those skills now ourselves. It's that serious. So I want to thank you, and I invite you now for comments and discussion. The Vatican was the first power. Mussolini made the Vatican a government in 1928. Was it eight? Late 20s. And so as a government, they were the first power to recognize Hitler, the Nazi regime. And there was a thing called the Concordat between Pope Pius the whatever number, doesn't matter. And there's a good book about it called Hitler's Pope. And so they worked out a deal with Hitler whereby the church would give it legitimacy in return for the Hitler not touching church property. They didn't say anything about the nuns and priests, because in fact a lot of nuns and priests ended up in concentration camps. But so Hitler didn't really honor as part of the deal. But the Catholic Church all around the world said, this is a Christian government holding the fort against Bolshevism, and so we need to support it. And so, yeah, there's that long history. There was I knew a lot of people in a house, and it was interesting because back in late summer, there was about the Tamiflu drug.
No, that was late
September, early October. Okay. The Nanaimo Daily News actually reported that there were public health nurses pushing the Tamiflu drug out in a house. And like you know, I mean, Native people are very immune compromised. I mean, you don't shove, and I see this all the time. I work part time in the downtown east side. And one of the things you often see are nurses from Providence Healthcare, which is Catholic Church, out in the alleys. I mean, literally shoving needles into the arms of homeless Native men all the time. And these public health nurses apparently were pushing Tamiflu in a house. And within, how long was it?
Well, it was just a couple, like 2 weeks later, literally. Yeah.
They declared that the BC health officer declared a house at a pandemic zone. Even though it's one of the most isolated Indian villages in the country, you got to get there only by boat. So how come it breaks out there first and not in downtown Vancouver? Obviously introduced. So, I mean, now that's not unusual because they know legally under the Indian Act you can do that as a government. No native under Section 76 of the Indian Act, which is still in effect, it's never been revoked, you cannot refuse medical treatment if you're a native person or reserve. They know they can do it legally. My friend Candace, who is a public health nurse, she came on my radio program a number of times. And I do a co-op radio in Vancouver. I do a Monday program there. And she described how in 2000 she was she tried to do a workshop on alternatives to vaccinations out of the Stola Reserve near Abbotsford. She was fired like that by the medical services branch for doing that. And she found that nurses were going into the homes on the Stola Reserve and literally just sticking in the arms of little kids and older people. And three elders she knew died after the flu vaccine. And same branch that was doing experiments in the Indian hospitals. I don't know a hell of a lot about it. I mean, I know that there's Providence Healthcare is out of St. Paul's Hospital. And we know that St. Paul's is a hospital when the kids on the Squamish and Seashell Catholic residential schools, and Harry Nahani and other eyewitnesses described them bringing in the bodies, and they would process the bodies through the hospitals like St. Paul's, issue fake death certificates. St. Paul's was one of them. So Providence Healthcare operates out of that. But in a little bit of research, I found that, of course, they are partners with the provincial government through the different health agencies. West Coast Health here on the island and what's it called in Vancouver? Vancouver Coastal. So they're partnerships with the government. They don't just operate on their own. And long ago, they were talking about how everybody needs the swine flu and they're going to target homeless Native people because they are the ones most in need of it. And in fact, I know some of the people I know, they're paid, Rob gets 80 bucks a day they pay to homeless guys to get their fellow homeless to kind of round them up like the black sheep and bring them in for shots. So Rob, one of my friends, is doing that. So that they do rely on that kind of, they know how desperate people are. It's why the people take the money, you know, for the settlements because they're so desperate. The government officials' figures was that 125,000 children were in the schools. Very low because that's based on the law, which is when you were seven, you had to go into a school. But the Mounties would clear out whole villages. They'd take all of the kids often. So 2-, 3-, 4-year-old kids, if you can imagine, in these places. So if you double the number, and the average death rate was 50%, that's been admitted now. Finally, the Globe and Mail, in his wisdom, after 10 years of receiving this information, finally acknowledged, yeah, half the children died. They printed a report by Dr. Peter Bryce, which is in my book here. He came out here on the coast and in the prairies and found that half the children were dying because as a regular practice, the churches were taking healthy children and putting them in the same dorm as children dying of tuberculosis, locking the door and not treating them. So what's going to happen? And so that accounted for the very high death rate. So if you're talking 50%, you're talking anywhere between 50 and 100,000 children over a century, which isn't a lot when you think of it. That means that in every residential school, you had to have 5 to 10 deaths per year in every residential school to get that figure. And we know in the early years it was a lot higher than that. The two films, Unrepentant, we did in 2006. You can get, like I say, I have copies. And it was done as a documentary based on my book. The second film was a feature film we just completed, and it was based kind of partly on my story and all this evidence. It's called The Diary. And it was filmed here on the island. It utilized Native people and some survivors of residential schools and talent out of the Victoria Film School, which is really good. It was quite a process. Basically, the storyline is about a little girl called Raven who keeps a diary in the residential school, and then she dies. It's hidden, and then this minister is handed the diary, and he has to decide what he wants to do with it. And so it's that whole drama unfolding itself. You can find it on thediarymovie.com. thediarymovie.com and then /trailer, and you can see some of the trailers and the other stuff on that. Yeah. We know where some of them are. We know where 28 of them are, mostly in Western Canada. Okay, the thing is, it wasn't my job to grab a shovel and go start disturbing remains, but it's the job of the families and the people whose land that's on to say, well, what are we going to do with this? According to our protocols and traditions, what are we going to do? Because, you know, when the remains of elders are found in bent boxes in museums all over the world, there's a repatriation process. The Haida Nation began last decade, where they began to bring home the remains of those elders that were in museums. Well, this is a much bigger thing. And in fact, the same group on Haida that did that, I approached, and they were considering doing that. They were considering going to the government and saying, we're going to bring back these children. And then it stopped. As so often happens, suddenly goes off the radar screen. They never call back. They don't want to talk to me anymore, blah, blah, blah. So, no. If you go to Port Alberni, okay, go in behind the Tribal Council office. It's on. You go up River Road, then off just past the bridge, you go up this long winding road to the Netchelmouth Tribal Council office. You go around back, and you look up in the hills, and that's where the mass grave is. And if you walk in over the fence, past the water pipeline, and we had a group go in there and actually do a forensic assessment team. They did a survey map. And one of these guys had been in Bosnia, and he's seen a lot of mass graves. And he said, that's a classic mass grave because of all the sinkholes. There's 10 rows of sinkholes, the vegetation. He says there's probably hundreds of bodies in there. That's right in Port Alberni. Now, the RCMP, we called him last February, and he said, we don't have any record of children dying. And I said, don't you read the Globe and Mail? I mean, like, your own prime minister now has admitted this happened, and you are saying, I mean, it's just a gross cover-up, right? They're just the RCMP, of course, because the RCMP were mandated to go gather the kids in. So are they going to investigate it? It's got to be us who do it. It's got to be citizens. That's what we've been pushing for a long time. Well, the St. Georgetown University, the Jesuit College, that's where a lot of politicians in the States are trained. I mean, it's like, it's a long history, and sure. I think, you know, it's by the old saying of Jesus, by their fruits you will know them. I mean, if children are dying, you don't have to be even an official Satanist to be doing that work. You know, so, I mean, you just judge it. And, you know, it's funny when you approach people in the churches about this, there's this kind of amazing, you're talking about mind control. I mean, there's this amazing blind spot about do you remember when we're outside these churches and people come up and yell at us, we've dealt with this. You know, we've dealt with this. We've issued the apology. We've given the money. What more do they want? I mean, they're just out to blah, blah, blah. You know, you see all this credible nonsense. And it's like that is kind of one of the stages of denial, like when you're facing your own death. I mean, I've seen this. We've all seen this. When it's kind of in Canada, we're not even at the point of acknowledgement, though, that these things happen in a lot of ways. And we have to get this stuff into the curriculum, into the mainstream consciousness, so that we can say, okay, if it happened to them, well, then maybe something else. Maybe our country isn't the way we figure it is. You know, this has ramifications much beyond just the issue of genocide and Native people. Yep. Somebody once called, I don't know what your experience is of the United Church, but, you know, I was raised in it, and somebody once called it spiritual jello. Because, like, you're not supposed to believe anything because that might cause division. You're supposed to be nice to everybody. It's the consummate Canadian church, because English Canadian church. We're supposed to be nice and send out good positive energy and don't, you know, what's more divisive than the gospel? I mean, you know, Jesus, it's not a gospel of niceness at all. So, I mean, I always found that funny as a minister to try to, you know, all the pressure was when you're in the pulpit to translate it to be acceptable to people here so they can get by in the week and have a good life and not real. I mean, that's the culture. And so in a way, it's not hard that for this, you know, not to penetrate those people. But I think that when you look at just the fact that this is about children, right? And I say, you know, often to say to people, okay, your child, she's taken away. You never see her again. She's gone. She's dead somewhere buried in a hill. The people who did it come to you and say, we're sorry. Here's the money. Would that satisfy you? They say, of course not. Well, then why would it satisfy a Native person? Just put yourself in their shoes for 1 second, and suddenly the whole house of cards falls. And that's what they're so afraid of, and that's why they have to continue to, well, discredit this whole campaign, discredit everything about it, because otherwise Canada is a house of cards. What are we based on? What are we built on? That. We're built on that. And so they know this has a much bigger impact. And you talked about the spiritual. I mean, my spiritual beliefs were false because it was based on that equation of Christianity with the church. And it's all about separating that out. Say, we don't have to be part of a genocidal tradition. In fact, if you really follow the teachings, you're against that. You're an enemy of the church. Okay, basically what the RCMP has mandated in the early 1930s to be the police arm of the residential school. They gather up the kids, they chase them down when they run away. And so they're implicated up to their eyebrows in this stuff. The first taste I had of that was in the death of Maisie Shaw, who you'll read about or hear about in the film, killed in 1946. We went to try to get that investigated. The RCMP flat out refused. They said, the perpetrator's dead. We can't do anything. And I said, well, have you ever heard of, A, the fact that there's no statute of limitation on murder, and B, he might have had accomplices, and how do you know that this didn't happen? But the Mounties refused. That was in the spring of 1996. That's been the attitude right all along down the line. No evidence, just outright. And you saw the statement of the guy in Port Alberni that it's just fabricate lies and all sorts of evasion to avoid looking into that. So again, it's kind of like the law of indigenous rights at the UN. Like, why would they? Why would they cooperate in looking into this? You can't expect that out of the institutions that committed the crime. So that's why you don't look to those. You don't look, and I got to say this about this Truth and Reconciliation Commission you're going to hear about, which is utter horseshit. I mean, when you look at the mandate of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, first of all, the TRC commissioners are appointed by the very churches that are going to be investigated. Okay? There's no naming allowed. There's no immunity granted to people when they give testimony. You can't talk about wrongdoing in a residential school unless it's been before a court, and most of these things have never been, including none of the murders. You're going to hear a lot about this, but it's designed to cover things up. It's not designed. Okay, so what is needed and what we've been pushing for is independent inquiry based. And there's, in fact, one of the reasons I'm going back to Europe is there's a movement in the European Parliament to investigate Canada. And we're going to have international observers come in and do that, like we tried 10 years ago, but that was shut down. That's all in my film and books and everything. You can read about it. But it needs to be independent. And basically, you've got to put the whole system on trial. And I think the reason that's important for all of us is that it has tremendous repercussions. If we're able to do that to Canada over this, we can also do it on any of these issues because it's all about the same thing, really, when you come down to it. So I think it's a process we should all work on together. And just to close, because I've only got a few minutes, but then got to run. Please contact me because I'm available all the time to sit down with people. A lot of you know we can sit down and talk about all this. It's what I do now. That's all I've been doing for 15 years. But hiddenfromhistory.org. And hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca is my email. I want to thank you. I'm sorry I've got to run. This is just, but I would like to thank you.